Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the program. Kyle Mabry is at the controls. Among the world's wealthy nations, the United States stands out for its failure to establish a general system for financing health care. Those Americans who do have access pay more for their prescription medicines, for their hospital care and doctor's visits than do citizens of other industrialized nations. With all of the many problems of America's health care system, and there are many and they are pretty obvious, here's the question: why is it that it has been so hard to change? Well, this morning in this hour of Focus, we will be looking at the century-long debate in this country over health care, and our guest is Paul Starr. He is a professor of sociology at Princeton University, and he is the author of a recent book that we'll be talking about. The title of his book is Remedy and Reaction, The Peculiar American Struggle Over Healthcare Reform. It's published by the Yale University Press and is fairly recently out. It's an issue that he has been dealing with writing about for quite a long time. And he was, in fact, a senior healthcare advisor to the Clinton White House in 1993. So he was somebody who had some up-close and personal experience with the effort to create a healthcare system for the country that happened during the Clinton administration. So he can talk about that. We'll talk a little bit about where we are now, trying to get a little bit of perspective on where we have come from on this issue. And, of course, for people who are listening, questions, comments are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And also, if you'd like to do an email, you can send us a question that way. We'd be happy to have it, and that's will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, questions, comments are welcome. The only thing we ask is that people just try to be brief so we can get in as many folks as possible and keep the program moving along. But all input is welcome. And Professor Starr, hello.
Good to be with you, David.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. As a kind of a general way of starting, and then we'll get right to where we are right now. I'm sure that the basic question that people have, particularly looking at the fact that we've been talking about this for close to 100 years, is the very one I said was the central question here. Why is it that it has been so difficult, in spite of the efforts of so many people and a number of presidential administrations, to get any movement on this issue?
Yeah, you know, every other major democracy has more or less put to rest the basic question of whether there should be public responsibility for the cost of illness. The United States stands out. It stands out not only because we haven't resolved the problems, but because in recent decades the battle has become more toxic than ever. Instead of moving to closure, getting resolution on it, we've been moving further apart. And I think there are really two parts to the story. The first has to do with what happened in the first half of the 20th century when the United States kind of got off the track of development that every other Western country followed in developing a public system for financing health insurance. And then what happened in the middle of the 20th century? We adopted a series of partial measures that satisfied the best organized groups in the society. We have a good tax break for employer-sponsored insurance. We have the veteran system. We passed the Medicare program and Medicaid. And having adopted all of these partial measures, it became very difficult to take the next step and provide insurance for the remaining people who didn't have it and to control the cost of health care. And what happened is we created for ourselves what I call a policy trap. And the trap, while satisfying a lot of people, made the various policies we adopted made the system increasingly complicated, increasingly expensive, but tremendously enriched the healthcare industry, satisfied these best organized groups, concealed a lot of the costs. People don't really feel those costs as clearly as they would if they had to pay one lump sum a month out of their pocket. And finally, a lot of groups got moral arguments as to why they deserved the health care they have. The veterans served in the wars. Employees with good benefits are working for those benefits. Medicare beneficiaries work their whole lives. Each group feels it earned its benefits. Nothing should be taken away. And they don't want to be taxed to pay for anybody else. So the policies help to create a message that make it difficult to resolve the issue.
Yeah, that's really it seems unfortunate, but perhaps that's the reality of politics, that if we identify the two big problems as being the uninsured and the cost of health care, there doesn't seem to be much in the way of constituencies, or at least powerful constituencies, that would push those issues, that is, providing health insurance for people who don't already have it, and then also dealing with the issue of cost.
Well, all of these factors made it difficult to address. But nonetheless, this has become, addressing this problem has become what I call in the book a politically treacherous national imperative. It's still a national imperative because we are spending phenomenally more on health care than any other country, not just a little, phenomenally more. It is eating away at our national budget, at state budgets. It is eating away at people's paychecks. They're not getting the increases in wages that they would otherwise get. And so it's hurting us. And people who study the problem, and many, many groups, know that we have to deal with it. It's just that there is a deep interest in maintaining the status quo. And every time we try to change it, we get a reaction. And that's the reason for the title of the book, Remedy and Reaction. Every remedy has drawn a sharp reaction. And you know, we did finally pass legislation in 2010. It's quite possible that it will be repealed, and we will go through another cycle of national frustration.
Well, it has just this morning, in fact, not too long ago, the U.S. Supreme Court has announced that it will hear arguments in March on the constitutionality of the health care overhaul that President Obama managed to get through Congress. There's a question here about, there always has been a question of how the court would rule. And then in addition to that, there are people in Washington, Republicans, who say that they would do everything they could to try to get it repealed. So there are a couple of things that touch on the future of this act, the Affordable Care Act.
Absolutely. The first issue that's going to come is that Supreme Court decision. It concerns the provision in the law known as the individual mandate, the requirement to maintain a minimum level of health coverage. I think that whole issue could have been avoided. I was not in favor of the mandate in the form that it passed, but it did pass that way, and now we will see whether the court upholds it or not. Very interesting thing, however, about this Supreme Court announcement. So that they have scheduled a full week of arguments over this case. I don't think there's any precedent for that, the amount of time they're going to devote to hearing oral argument. And the first day is over a question which I think very few people are aware of. And that has to do with whether or not there can be any court decision on this issue at all now. There is an obscure 1867 law that says that no one can sue against any tax to prevent the imposition of a tax before it's actually imposed. And if the court says that 1867 law applies in this case, then there can't be any decision on the individual mandate until 2015. And interestingly, that was the position of one of the Court of Appeals in Richmond, and it is the position taken by one of the most conservative judges on the District of Columbia Court of Appeals. And I think this is really very interesting as a possibility. There's, first of all, a very technical legal issue involved, but there is also an institutional issue. Does the court want to interject itself into this question in the middle of an election season. Whichever way it decides the case, it will seem to be a highly politicized decision. So it may, for institutional reasons, partly hold back from making a decision. Judge Brett Kavanaugh, this conservative judge in the D.C. Circuit Court, noted at the very end of his decision that if the court defers the decision until 2015, the issue may never come back. The law may be revised, it may be repealed, and Kavanaugh was really suggesting in that opinion that it would really be a better thing for the court not to resolve this. And he was saying this as a conservative. Interesting, he said that there are many conservative proposals to privatize government programs, and here think of Social Security, and those programs that use private substitutes for government services often require mandates of this kind. And Kavanaugh was cautioning other conservatives against setting a precedent in this area that could interfere or delegitimize other ideas that conservatives favor. So I think it's a really interesting question whether some of the conservative judges on the court may be attracted to this possibility of not deciding the case at all this year.
Let me very quickly introduce again the guest for this hour of Focus, Paul Starr. He's professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University, co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect. He is the author of a number of books, and including this most recent that we're talking about here, Remedy and Reaction, The Peculiar American Struggle Over Healthcare Reform. It is published by the Yale University Press and tries to give some overview of the conversation, debate that has been going on in this country on the subject over, roughly speaking, the last 100 years. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. I think I read recently somebody writing about how Americans think about politics and government. And the observation was something like, well, you know, sort of in the abstract, they're okay with what government does, but they just don't like to see the sausage being made. And the longer the process grinds on, the more unhappy people get. And here certainly is one of those examples where this was the healthcare debate. It was long. It seemed to be painful. There was a lot of rancor. There was a lot of debate. And it's very complicated. So if, though, having said all that, if one was going to reduce the package that the president managed to get through, Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, as it is known, if you're going to reduce that to its simplest elements, how would you tell somebody what it was all about?
Okay, let me just first go back to the point you started out with about how the long legislative process drags down public support. And that is something that has been observed for many different pieces of legislation. You have a predictable pattern in public opinion, often very high support at the beginning, and then as time drags on, the support goes down. Things become more complicated, the opposition arises, and I'm not just talking about healthcare. This is a very general pattern. When Medicare was under consideration by Congress in 1965, Lyndon Johnson said to one of the key congressional leaders, don't let dead cats sit on the porch. I have no idea what dead cats referred to. But in any event, it was Johnson's knowledge, experience, that taught him that you can't let these things drag on forever. So what is the core of the Affordable Care Act? The core is to change the way the health insurance market works. And today, insurers, private insurers, have every incentive, every reason to avoid sick people. And the idea here is to reshape the market, and we're talking particularly about the market for people who buy insurance on their own or for small businesses who buy for very small groups of people, to create a new kind of market where people cannot be denied coverage. The price that's quoted to them will not reflect their own personal individual health experience, where people with low incomes, close to the poverty level, will get subsidies on a kind of sliding scale to enable them to afford a basic standard of coverage. That's the most important part of the act. It provides it also expands the Medicaid program, which in many states is very limited. It varies tremendously from state to state. So you have very generous programs in a state like Vermont, and then you have very limited programs in a state like Louisiana. And this now creates more uniform standards for the country as a whole for Medicaid. And then above Medicaid, above the poverty level, it has this sliding scale to enable people to afford private insurance coverage. Let me just, if you look at this in historical perspective, this is a lot like the proposals that moderate Republicans have made over the years. And in fact, as many of the candidates have said in the Republican primaries, the national legislation is very similar to the legislation that Mitt Romney enacted in Massachusetts a few years ago. This is an approach which you can trace back through the years. It's more similar, for example, to what Richard Nixon was proposing in the early 1970s than it is to what Senator Kennedy was proposing back then. So this is relatively centrist legislation, really.
All right, let's talk with a caller. We have somebody here who is calling in from Effingham, so we'll go there, and that's line number 4. Hello.
Thank you, David. If it's already been covered, sorry if I'm redundant. In my recent memory is Hillary Clinton making a statement that everyone would have to buy health care insurance, and I interpret that as meaning just like you have, if you're going to drive an automobile, you've got to have liability insurance at the least amount you have to have. And I wonder if your guest, if you've covered it, I'm sorry, but that stuck with me. How is it possible, for someone with substandard wages then to take part of that wage and to buy health care insurance? I'll ring off and listen. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, well, as Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton doesn't have much to do with this anymore, but it is true that the legislation has that kind of minimum requirement in it. The minimum requirement also comes with the subsidies that I mentioned before. So people up to and just slightly above the poverty level get covered without any cost under Medicaid. People above that level get sliding scale subsidies to enable them to buy a minimum, sort of a basic insurance package. And that's going to limit their costs to, but again, it depends exactly what their income is. Near the poverty level, it's down at 2-3% of income, and then it goes up to about 7 or 8% of income. So the idea is, just as the name of the legislation suggests, to make insurance affordable even to those people in low-wage jobs.
All right. Well, other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. This, maybe you might talk a little bit more about the tortured history of the individual mandate. You mentioned that now a lot of Republicans are down on the idea of the individual mandate, although if you don't have to go back too much further, you do in fact find that one of the leading contenders, when he was governor of Massachusetts, embraced the individual mandate, and even conservative think tanks like the Heritage Foundation were pushing for the individual mandate as a reaction against the idea, which had some favor before that, of this being a requirement that employers provide health care. So maybe
right.
You can talk a little bit about how it is that, in fact, both parties have kind of seesawed back and forth between the idea that it should be the responsibility of the individual or it should be the responsibility of their employer.
Yeah. So in the early 90s, when President Clinton proposed a health plan that relied on an employer mandate, and by the way, Richard Nixon's plan had also had an employer mandate, so you have some Republican history there, too. But by the 90s, many Republicans were saying, oh, an employer mandate would be too much government. Let's have an individual mandate instead. And that was the basis of a bill proposed by 20 Senate Republicans, including the Senate Minority Leader at that time, Senator Robert Dole. So that idea came out of came from conservatives, came from the Heritage Foundation, and when Governor Romney was looking for a way to provide health insurance to everyone in Massachusetts, he turned to the Heritage Foundation. He turned to that approach that relied on an individual mandate. Now, Democrats, I think, thought that by adopting the Romney approach in Massachusetts, they could get some Republican support in Congress. They could reach across the aisle and create a bipartisan bill. But as you know, it didn't work out that way. And now Republicans have turned completely against the individual mandate. And it's not just Romney. Newt Gingrich also endorsed an individual mandate at one point. So we have a strange reversal here. It seems, you know, once Democrats adopted the idea, Republicans fled from it. But I don't actually think the bill required an individual mandate. And during the debate on the legislation, I urged that there be an alternative, a way for people to opt out, because even though I wouldn't recommend that anybody opt out, I saw the likelihood of a backlash against it, the potential for legal problems, the kind of court case that's being brought now, and I think there were ways around it. I have an article actually in the current issue of the New Republic called "The Mandate Miscalculation," arguing that as a policy, as a legal principle, there were really severe problems there from the beginning. Now, what a lot of people don't understand about this individual mandate is that it really isn't a mandate. You probably think, most people listening probably think that if they don't comply with a mandate, they would be punished in some way. But actually, there are no penalties in the bill. You can't go to jail. You can't have your property seized. You can't have your wages garnished. The law actually denies the federal government any power to enforce the mandate except withholding a tax refund. That's the only available way for the government to enforce the mandate. It isn't really much of an enforcement power at all.
Well, just for a second, staying with the issue of what Massachusetts adopted and whether, in fact, if now Mitt Romney, you know, say he should become the Republican nominee,
yeah,
will he be able to say, well, that when people make the argument that essentially what happened nationally was the same thing that happened when he was the governor, would he be able to say, well, actually, no, that there is some kind of substantial difference between what was adopted in Massachusetts and the Affordable Care Act?
Well, he does take that position. He says, first of all, that it's constitutionally wrong for the federal government to adopt the same provision that Massachusetts adopted, that different states should be allowed to do different things. And actually, the president agrees with with Mitt Romney on that and has favored adding a waiver to the bill that would allow states to substitute alternative ways of going about providing health insurance to their citizens. So I think if they have a debate, President Obama, that is if Mitt Romney is the nominee, will probably agree with Romney on that point, on providing more latitude for states to do different things. But that, by the way, includes the mandate provision. I think Governor Romney draws other differences. You know, the federal bill is not identical to the state bill, of course. But, you know, if you think about the general structure of the bill, they're very, very similar. And Massachusetts required a lot of federal money in order to be able to carry it out. So it's not as though Massachusetts did it all on its own.
I have a question here, an email that essentially poses two big questions, and maybe I should ask them separately. One, the first one, the person who was listening raises the question, how can the new law be sustained under the system now in place? They go on to say that they're thinking about how insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies are working toward the highest possible profit over the benefit of the population as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Well, the law contains a number of provisions that limit the the kinds of profits that insurers can make. So let me just explain. There's so many different aspects of the law. It's really easy to get lost on this. So the law says that the percentage of a premium that goes for other things besides medical care is now going to be limited. So in the past, people who've been buying insurance individually have actually only been getting about 70 cents on the dollar for medical care, because about 30 cents on the dollar gets eaten up by the bureaucracy and by the profits of the insurance companies and by the brokers and all the others involved. Under the new system that's going to be created, we're going to have these health insurance exchanges that are going to allow you to go online and make a choice of an insurer, put in some information. Massachusetts already does this, very, very efficient. Cuts out a lot of the costs of doing the transaction. And the law is going to regulate how much profit and other overhead the insurers can charge. And that's going to be significantly less than it has been in the past. That's one way in which the law is going to try to bring down the cost for the consumers.
The other question, and may indeed be something you would talk about for a long time, but for the other question, the caller raises the case of, say, Canada or the UK, and one might bring in whatever other country that you might want to, other industrial democracies, and ask the question, essentially asking the question, what can we learn from them, and could we adopt the kind of approach that they take?
Not at this point, because we've developed institutions that perhaps should never have developed in the way they did in the first place, but it's now in a way too late. We have an existing system of hospitals, medical care, insurance companies. One lesson we do have to take from other countries is that they built on the structures they had, and if we tried to simply throw it all out in favor of, Britain has a national health service, owns all the hospitals, the government owns all the hospitals, it would be just tremendously disruptive. People would be very unhappy about how severe and abrupt a change that would be. What this law tries to do is to work with the institutions that we have, with things that people are familiar with. The great majority of people who have employer-provided insurance, who have Medicare, who use the veterans' hospitals or whatever, they're not going to see a big change. And this was consciously an effort to try to minimize the resistance and the anxiety that have met every proposal for reform.
Our guest this morning in this hour of focus is Paul Starr. He is a professor of sociology at Princeton University. We're talking about national health care. We'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails. He co-wrote the music for The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Last year, he won an Oscar for the score for The Social Network. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible by the Friends of WILL and by The Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta, located in Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. We're here Monday through Friday with two different topics for you every morning from 10 until noon. We're on tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour. We will talk with Joshua Landis. He's director of the Center for Middle East Studies at University of Oklahoma and one of the country's leading experts on Syria. And we'll talk about current events in Syria, what's been going on there over the past few months. Then in the second hour, some questions about nursing homes, particularly if you're looking to place someone who is close to you in a nursing home, how do you find a good one? Our guest there will be Dr. Joshua Shore. He's an internist and geriatrician and is author of the book The Nursing Home Guide, A Doctor Reveals What You Need to Know About Long-Term Care. That's tomorrow. You can check on the schedule for the days to come by going to our website. That's WILL.illinois.edu. You also can listen to past programs there, perhaps catch up on some that you might have missed the first time around. In this hour of focus, our guest is Paul Starr. He's professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University. He's co-founder, co-editor of the American Prospect, and is author of a new book that looks at the history of the struggle over health care reform in this country. The title of his book is Remedy and Reaction, and it's published by the Yale University Press. We're happy to take calls here from people who are listening. Questions, comments, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And let us talk with someone here in Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. Well, I disagree. I think the fight has to be joined on the level that was alluded to go to a system like a single-payer system in Canada. After the war, and when the NHS was developed, it was a revolutionary thing in the UK. I mean, I think it's a good battle to pick, and I think depending on how you ask the question, you get very good support for a single payer system, despite the fact that it doesn't get in the door unless I like to go back to the part of history, and I maybe you survey it in your book, the Health America Act, which was the full name of the Clinton plan. Our Senator Simon at the time introduced improvements to the said system, and what he suggested included a state single-payer option. And Vermont is wanting to do this. People I talk to don't know that in California, single-payer was passed twice. It was passed when they had a Republican governor, and maybe they passed it knowing that it wasn't going to get past the veto pen. But if you look at the economics of it, the single payer or a system comparable to it is the only way to deal with this, quote, looming budget deficit. If you run the numbers in, I think, the correct way, just taking that waste that you referred to, 30% for the individual insuree, if you take that out and apply it in the right way, it actually takes out the entirety of the deficit in the future. And it makes healthcare actually focus on healthcare rather than all these extra expenses of paying for the insurance industry and denying care, et cetera, et cetera. So we really have to join that fight, and maybe it can be done through an opt-out from the state so they can reprogram all their funding a la what Vermont wants to do and what was proposed by Senator Simon and kind of how it happened in Canada where it started in Saskatchewan. So I'd like you to respond.
All right. Well, Professor Starr.
Coverage. Germany and Japan and Switzerland and the Netherlands don't have single-payer systems. They have multi-payer systems, but they have comprehensive regulation of those payers and often negotiations at the national or regional level between the payers and the providers, and they keep costs down that way, and they do it very successfully. So, you know, there's not just one formula for getting health care for all. There are many ways to do it. And, it is true that if we nationalize the entire insurance industry, there would be some savings, although not nearly as much as the caller was suggesting, because the overhead for large employers gets us down to the 7% range. A good national program would probably be at the 3 to 4-5% range. There's some savings there. But there are many other issues that really overwhelm the healthcare cost perspective. So I don't think that's it's not likely to happen. The history of California, by the way, is different. There was a referendum in California in the 90s over single payer. It lost 3 or 4 to 1. when these issues come into the political arena, they create coalitions that ultimately end up defeating single payer. So, you know, I understand the interest, I understand the logic, but it is not going to happen. And, you know, I just think the political experience is very different. So,
Well, I have some other callers here I want to get to. I do want to, just if it's possible, to give a relatively brief response for you to talk about what it was that the Obama administration did differently that made it possible for it to be successful when the Clinton administration was not.
Okay. Well, I think the circumstances in 2009 were dramatically different from 1993 and have not that much to do with what the Obama administration did versus the Clinton administration. So in the early 90s, there were a variety of different ideas among reformers and within the Democratic Party, so that when Clinton was elected, he faced a fragmented political situation in his own party. In Congress, Democrats had control of both the House and the Senate, but they went in entirely different directions. The different committees went in entirely different directions, and Clinton was unable to create a consensus on behalf of the program that he proposed. Obama faced a totally different situation. There had developed in the years leading up to his election a much higher level of consensus among reformers and even among interest groups, as well as Democrats in Congress. They basically agreed on the approach. They had dropped back from the more ambitious goals that Senator Kennedy had once supported, or, for example, even that President Clinton supported. So this was a much more modest program. As I mentioned, it had roots in Republican ideas, that made it much easier to enact legislation, although in the end, it was enacted only with Democratic votes, and it would not have been enacted if Democrats didn't have 60 votes in the Senate for a short time, something that President Clinton never did have.
Yeah, all right. To another caller here, Indiana, toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello. I want to mention something to see if it's actual fact or whether or not I've just believed this all these years and I've got wrong information. Where I am in Indiana, there are no monies are used for dental care. But I swear to God that some program I heard that there are some states who do have dental care for their senior citizens, and I don't know whether it's through Medicare or Medicaid or whatever it is, but it reasonably comes from the federal government, and then they splice it up the way they want to. I wonder if you could speak to that, if that is a fact, and if the states are allowed to mess around with the cutting up of the pie, exactly what controls are on that from the feds? Thank you.
Right.
Well, the caller has hit an area of my ignorance. I do not know what the various state Medicaid programs do on dental care. It's not covered under Medicare, but some state programs, I think, do cover dental. Some of the child health insurance programs may also cover dental. And indeed, in this legislation, there will be pediatric dental care. There is coverage of that, not for adults but for children. But this is just not an area. I'm sorry, I don't know enough about this.
All right, we'll just go on to another caller here. This is someone in Urbana now on our line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Well, first of all, I guess I could just like to say, to me, it feels like this is kind of Republican obstructionist type of things where, you know, they decide that they believe in a certain thing, you know, and then when the Democrats jump on board and say, hey, yeah, we like that idea, it makes sense to us, the Republicans decide that they don't like this sort of thing simply to be obstructionists. Having said that, I'm curious, and I consider myself fairly liberal, and I don't believe in privatization as such when it comes to, you know, nationwide issues. And I guess I've wondered, though, how come hospitals have never kind of jumped on board and supplied their own insurance to people? That way you can kind of manage from the hospital, from the ground floor, your health care costs, keep them down, hopefully, and keep the insurance costs down. But I guess I just feel like, and I don't know if you have an answer to that or not, but I guess I just feel like this is beating a dead horse. We've got many more issues out there that we need to be concentrating on. Perhaps we should move on, come back to this, tweak it as we need to, and you know, quit fighting every single thing that comes out. And I'll take my answers off the phone. Thanks.
Okay.
Okay, so the caller asks about hospitals and why hospitals didn't provide insurance, but in fact they did. That is the history of Blue Cross. Blue Cross began in the late 1920s and 1930s as a system provided by hospitals, and it was hospital associations that started Blue Cross plans. And unfortunately, I think a lot of what went wrong with health insurance in the United States owes to the fact that it began with that base in hospitals, and for a long time provided payment to hospitals on the basis of their costs. Well, if you pay anyone on the basis of costs, you invite their costs to increase. And when Medicare adopted that system that came from Blue Cross, it set in motion in the 1960s a tremendous increase in health care costs in the United States by comparison with other countries. Medicare eventually changed, doesn't pay hospitals that way, but the close relationship between hospitals and health insurers is as much of a problem as an advantage. Now, we may actually see a return to that under one provision of the Affordable Care Act. It's a provision that calls for the creation of what are called accountable care organizations. And those are organizations of doctors and hospitals and other providers that will provide comprehensive coverage, but agree to be held accountable for their performance on certain measurable indicators of how well they're doing. This is one of the experimental aspects of the legislation. It establishes demonstration projects to see whether this would work. So, you know, we'll see whether hospitals, together with doctors, can get back into the business of providing coverage and whether they do a good job.
Just it's something I'm curious about here. I wonder whether whether President Obama, after he became president, would have, and in the campaign, whether he would have taken health reform on as a big issue had he not been running against Hillary Clinton, who was steeped in it and who was coming from the administration that had made that a big priority. And if Obama had been running against somebody else, would he then, in his campaign and having been elected, would health care reform have been at the top of his domestic agenda?
Well, David, you actually point to one of the things that I argue in my book. I did interviews with people who worked in both the Clinton and Obama campaigns in 2008, as well as various people who had advised Barack Obama before the campaign and afterward. And what those people told me was that really before the 2008 campaign, that is really before 2007, Barack Obama had not that great an involvement in healthcare issues. When he served in Illinois, for example, in the state Senate, some but not a lot of involvement. And John Gruber, who met with Obama as early, I think, as 2006 when he was in the Senate, or 2007 in the Senate, and then later advised the White House, Gruber said he saw a tremendous change in the level of knowledge and commitment that Obama had to the issue in the course of 2008. I think the campaign made a real difference. I think the fact that Obama had to debate Hillary Clinton 21 times forced him to learn more about the health care issues. There were many constituency groups in the Democratic Party who demanded that Obama talk about the issue, address the issue, That's very clear from a series of events that happened during the campaign. So yeah, I think Hillary Clinton actually had a huge impact, even though she ended up as Secretary of State not having any direct involvement in the passage of the law.
We have about 6-7 minutes left in this part of Focus. Our guest is Paul Starr. He's professor of sociology at Princeton University. He's author of a book that looks at the long struggle over health care reform in the United States. The title of his book is Remedy and Reaction. It's published by the Yale University Press. To go back just a little bit, maybe more than a little bit, you would think, looking back in over the last 50-100 years, that if anybody, if there was any administration that could have made national health care happen, it was the administration that brought us Social Security. It would have been Franklin Roosevelt, and it was actually something that he did want to do. Why is it that even he could not make this happen?
In 1935, when he proposed the Social Security legislation, he did consider whether health insurance should be included in it. That was the view of many of his advisors. They wanted to go ahead with health insurance, but Roosevelt was worried about whether he could pass Social Security through Congress, and he felt that adding health insurance would draw the opposition of the American Medical Association, and it might just be the straw that would break the camel's back. It would just be too difficult. So he wanted to put it off, and he did try to come back to it. In fact, just when he died, his advisors were preparing a program and a speech on health care, and this is in 1944. He died before he was able to do anything about it. Harry Truman then picked it up. But after the Second World War, there was the Cold War, of course, and the opponents of health insurance pictured it as a kind of insidious communist idea, and they were able to defeat it on that basis. I think the closest we came was under Richard Nixon.
Interestingly enough, yeah.
Because Nixon supported a proposal first in 1971 and then a much more ambitious proposal in 1974 that that Democrats should have accepted right when it was offered. It is a more liberal proposal than anything that's been considered in recent years. And Senator Kennedy regretted very much later in life that he hadn't just accepted Nixon's plan. They were negotiating that at the time of Watergate. And if Watergate had just wounded Nixon instead of destroying his presidency, I think we would have actually had a national health insurance bill in 1974.
We're just coming down to a couple of minutes left. Maybe I will ask another point here that's come in on an email. Somebody who was raising the question of the high cost of prescription medicines, and certainly that's one of the things that we know makes healthcare expensive,
yeah.
And is asking the question, is there in the law that we've been talking about now, the Affordable Care Act, the one that's that was passed, is there something in that law to try to limit the cost of prescription medication?
Okay, so there's one very important part of the law that has actually already gone into effect that affects seniors. So the seniors listening will know that the Medicare prescription coverage has a big hole in it, the so-called donut hole, mm-hmm. when the coverage stops and then you have to accumulate several thousand dollars more in expenses before the coverage starts again. And the law closes up that donut hole very significantly. And I think we just had some new data from the federal government that about 2.5 million of the elderly are benefiting from that change this year. So that is a very direct benefit to seniors. There's a lot more that we could do to cut the cost of prescription drugs and to cut the cost of prescription drugs under the Medicare program. So that's just one step. I think in this case, the power of the drug industry was a significant deterrent to getting as much change there as we need.
Well, the one big thing that happened in healthcare, I think you would argue during the Bush administration, that is the second Bush administration, was the Medicare drug benefit,
yeah.
which turned out, I think, to be very controversial because a lot of people argued, well, you know, this ended up costing a whole lot more than we thought it was going to cost. And on top of that, there's a question about where was that money going to come from? How much did that actually add to the problem?
Well, first of all, it has helped a lot of seniors. In spite of all of the problems of that program, I think, you know, it has represented a step forward. And because so many drugs have gone from patent to generic form over the last decade, the costs of that program haven't turned out to be as high as many people thought it would be. So that's worked out a little bit better than at least I anticipated. But it's a very complicated program. We could have much lower costs under it. There's evidence, for example, from the way that Medicaid pays for drugs, that we could cut Medicare's drug costs by 20-30%. But you know, this was a program that I think President Bush favored in the hope that he would consolidate support among seniors. And you know, Florida in 2000 was irrelevant to that concern.
Yeah. Well, there we're going to have to stop, I guess, with the acknowledgement that it, at this point we'll have to see we can expect this will be an issue in the next year's election. So, well, how that factors in. And I suppose in the meantime, everyone's kind of holding their breath to see what the Supreme Court does in the spring.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, Professor Starr, thank you very much for giving us your time.
Thank you.
Paul Starr is professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University. He is the author of the book Remedy and Reaction, The Peculiar American Struggle Over Healthcare Reform. It's published by the Yale University Press.